Thank you so much, Paul. And first, I'd like to say I'm impressed how many of you are here rather than cross-country skiing across the Currier and Ives landscape that I drove through on the way to get here. So thank you for your seriousness of purpose on this beautiful day. I also wanted to express my gratitude to my husband, who spent most of yesterday digging my car out of about 40 inches of snow so that I could be here today. It was the first time I've ever been tempted to use PowerPoint was to show you precisely what my car looked like about 24 hours ago. I'm grateful, of course, to the J.B. Moore Society for International Law for inviting me to participate in this program on the Obama impact. As President Obama has made clear in his speech before the UN General Assembly this past fall, and also most recently upon receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, the administration is committed in word and deed to a new era of principled engagement with the world. This symposium offers a timely first look at the ambitious goals of the administration, the goals the administration has set for itself, and the practical impact of its efforts. I think it's particularly appropriate for this symposium to be held here, both because it's thankfully south of Washington, D.C., and also because of the University of Virginia's very long-standing and deep commitment to excellence in the teaching and scholarship of international law. Now, as Paul said, I'm also a faculty member at Columbia Law School, which makes it a special privilege for me to offer remarks at a program honoring John Bassett Moore. He, of course, was a graduate of this university, held a number of high positions at the State Department, including acting Secretary of State, and also held the first chair on international law at Columbia University, before going on to many other illustrious positions, including serving as the United States' first member on the Permanent Court of International Justice. But I'm here wearing my governmental hat, which means that I'm not allowed to say what I think anymore. It's taken some training. As Paul said, I'm currently on leave from Columbia to serve as the counselor on international law to the legal advisor. It's a long-standing position for a legal academic with expertise in international law and is held, I would note, by at least four current or former members of the Virginia faculty, including Professor Stephen, John Harrison, Curtis Bradley, and John Norton Moore. Now, like many in the Obama administration, I've only been there for 5 months. I began in early September, roughly a month after Harold Coe was sworn in as the legal advisor, and several weeks before Michael Posner was confirmed as the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. Others have come more recently, or their appointments are still pending. So my first observation on the subject of today's symposium on the Obama impact is that despite the fact that the administration recently celebrated its first anniversary, the administration is still extremely young. I've also now come to appreciate in a way that I could not have 6 months ago that it takes time to redirect the ship of state and that it's much more difficult to repair a system than it is to break it. So today's program is, in fact, a quite early examination of the impact of the Obama administration on its engagement with international law. The organizers of the program have focused two panels on critical aspects of this issue, one on the United States' relationship to the United Nations and the other on the United States' relationship to the law of war. Now, to help frame the discussion that is to come, I thought I would identify four commitments that I see reflected in the Obama administration's approach to international law and institutions, and then offer some examples on how these commitments are being implemented through the Office of the Legal Advisor, touching in particular on four areas: the law of 9/11, international justice, approaches to treaties and international agreements, and finally, human rights. Before starting that discussion, though, I wanted to offer a few observations about academics in government, which is a new experience for me. And This administration, you may know, has reached deeply into legal academia to pull out a large group of talented scholars with extensive expertise in international and foreign relations law issues. These include David Martin of this law school, who is the current general counsel to the Department of Homeland Security. He also served as general counsel to the INS in the Clinton administration. David is a good friend of mine. I had the privilege of going to Guantanamo with him in December. I've also had the pleasure of working with him on a number of other issues. Academics in the administration also include David Barron, Bill Burke-White, Tino Cuellar, Elena Kagan, Marty Lederman, Trevor Morrison, Samantha Power, Anne-Marie Slaughter, Cass Sunstein, Catherine Powell, and of course Harold Coe, the legal advisor. Now, for faculty here who have served in the government, whether as counselor on international law or in other positions, they will find no surprises in the three observations I'm going to offer. The first is the acronym barrier to entry into the executive branch. These are formidable. To the newcomer to the State Department, the barrier created by acronyms is only exceeded by the barriers of the design of the building itself, which is a labyrinth second to none, I would say. When I first arrived, I said, who designed this building? On every corner, there's a map of the floor so that you can pause when you're lost and try to figure out where you're supposed to go next. And someone responded without smiling, well, the Cubans obviously designed this building. The first day that I arrived, I sat in on a briefing by the legal advisor in which, other than briefly catching the words Iran and Honduras, I don't think I understood anything that was said in the meeting. It was all a blizzard of letters and acronyms. But I've found that through several weeks of intense kind of bar review focused study of the organizational chart of the State Department, you can master the acronym barrier. And it now seems perfectly normal to refer to people as S or D, that would be Secretary Clinton or the Deputy Secretary of State Steinberg, to refer to bureaus as SWCI or LCID, which is in fact a bureau, not a movie, to think about or talk about forward-leaning positions, not actions, and non-paper papers, and so on and so forth. Second and more lasting is the intensity of the workplace. Being a lawyer in the government is being like an attorney who only specializes in TRO practice. Hundreds of complex and important issues erupt every day, often unexpectedly and urgently, with the result that government decision makers are constantly bombarded with pressing questions that must be addressed. Strobe Talbot has been quoted as saying that a day in government is like going in the door to stand in front of a tennis ball machine all day long and be bombarded by tennis balls and frantically trying to reach out and grab a couple of them that will be your projects for the day as the others just go whizzing by you. And I think the analogy to the tennis ball machine is apt, but a more apt analogy might be to being in a nuclear accelerator. I mean, the number of issues going by that you don't have time to grapple with is extraordinary. And as a result of this, it's a tremendous challenge to people in the government on a daily basis to try to ensure that the urgent doesn't squeeze out the lasting and the important changes and decisions that need to be taken on. And then finally, from an academic's perspective, the legal questions are simply an intellectual feast. Every single issue that has come across my desk could be an exam question, it could be a law review article. In fact, the first question I had was an exam question that I had asked once upon a time. It involved the power of Congress to use the appropriations power to designate Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and whether or not this was constitutional. If so, could it be adjudicated under the political question doctrine? Now, the primary difference here is in academia, you would have weeks or even months to spend time thinking deep thoughts about this problem and coming up with a learned solution. And in the end, it's likely that no one would really care what you thought. In the government, you have about 5 minutes to come up with what you think the answer is. And you know, for better or for worse, everyone cares what you think, and they act accordingly. So to move on to the topic of today's symposium. I would say that the administration has articulated an Obama-Clinton doctrine, a vision that reflects commitments to four elements. The first is multilateral engagement. This was a consistent theme of the president's campaign and has been a consistent theme of his first year in office. The interdependence of the global community is very poignant to our president, who is the child of a father from Kenya and who himself as a child spent several years in Indonesia. In Cairo this summer, the president emphasized that the challenge of the 21st century can't be met by any one leader or any one nation, and he committed to an open dialogue and partnership by the United States with peoples and nations across regional divides based on mutual interest and mutual respect, as well as acknowledgement of the rights and responsibilities of all nations. Second is universality. At Oslo, President Obama affirmed that this country is founded on the ideal that all are created equal. In her December speech on the human rights agenda of this administration, Secretary Clinton reiterated that a commitment to human rights starts with universal standards and with holding everyone accountable to those standards, including ourselves. Third is the legitimating force of law, recognizing that law is not simply a constraint, but that it gives strength and legitimacy to government action. Both the president and the secretary are themselves outstanding lawyers, and as the president emphasized forcefully in his National Archives speech and elsewhere, the American political system was founded on a vision of common humanity, universal rights, and rule of law. He said, "It is fidelity to these values that makes us stronger and safer." And at Oslo, he reaffirmed that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do and isolates those who don't. In other words, pre-commitments such as the Geneva Conventions are not quaint and antiquated norms, but they are in fact the standards that give legitimacy to government action. Finally, these goals are to be achieved through a principled pragmatism and the exercise of smart power, the intelligent use of all means to our disposal, including diplomacy, promotion of democracy, development, and human rights. In articulating this principle, the president has recalled the words of Thomas Jefferson, the founder of this great university, that wisdom should teach us that the less we use our power, the greater it will be. These four principles, multilateral engagement, universality, fidelity to law, and principled pragmatism, establish that as America resumes its leadership role on the world stage, renewed respect for international law and institutions will be crucial to achieving our goals of peace, justice, and prosperity. Respect for law is an essential element of American influence, self-definition, and power. So I was brought, as Professor Stevens said, into the legal advisor's office as one of only three non-career people there to help give root to this vision. And how are these commitments being implemented through the legal advisor's office? On the assumption that not every one of you has necessarily already worked in the State Department, although I commend the position to you, I thought I would give you a little bit of information about the office itself. Affectionately known to insiders as L, that acronym, the Legal Advisor's Office is the primary locus of international law in the U.S. government, although there are other interpreters of international law within the executive branch. These include the Office of Legal Counsel, lawyers in the Justice Department, lawyers in the Defense Department, and other agencies. The legal advisor serves as the general counsel for the State Department, providing advice on all international and domestic legal issues that arise in the course of the department's work. The office is modeled on the legal advisor of the British Foreign Office, hence the spelling ER for legal advisor. the British spelling. Today, the Legal Advisor's Office is, I think, the finest international law firm in the world. As Professor Stevens said, it includes an elite cadre of over 170 extraordinarily talented and hardworking attorneys who represent clients in the 24-plus bureaus that comprise the State Department. L attorneys provide legal advice to regional bureaus, such as the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs, which has been centrally involved in coordinating the U.S. response to the Haitian earthquake. They also advise topic-specific bureaus in the State Department through L offices, such as the Office of Human Rights and Refugees, the Office of Political Military Affairs, whose assistant legal advisor, Ashley Deeks, will be speaking on the Law of War panel this afternoon, and also the Office of UN Affairs, whose attorney advisor, Darren Johnson, will be speaking on the next panel regarding the United States and the United Nations. L attorneys, for those with wanderlust, are also stationed at The Hague, in Geneva, in Baghdad, and the UN headquarters in New York. The work of the office is highly collaborative. Generally, many L offices are involved in a particular action or decision. For example, a negotiation of an arms proliferation agreement with the Russian Federation could involve input and drafting from attorneys in a variety of offices, including the Office of European Affairs, the Office of Treaty Affairs, the Office of Nonproliferation and Verification, and the Office of Political Military Affairs. In addition to the highly collaborative work on such projects, the Legal Advisor's Office is involved in in-house review of the many department communications, policies, memoranda, and diplomatic notes in a process referred to as clearing. Frequently, multiple sections of the State Department and thus multiple sections of the Legal Advisor's Office must clear on a single document or policy before it can be presented to the Secretary for her decision or before it can be announced to the public. So literally, every word that comes out of the Secretary's mouth or the spokesperson for the State Department will have been cleared by multiple bureaus within the State Department. In addition, State Department actions that implicate interests of other government agencies are cleared through what is known as an interagency clearance process, in which other relevant agencies, be they the Justice Department, the Defense Department, Homeland Security, the National Security Council, et cetera, must also clear those positions before they can be rendered public. Hence, part of the slowness in redirecting the ship of state. But although this is a cumbersome process, I have come to respect it as a way of ensuring that widespread and diverse relevant knowledge from various interested offices is brought to bear on government decisions, and that positions are not taken by one agency or entity that are adverse to interests of other parts of the U.S. government, and that includes the United States' interests in compliance with international law. It is the unique role of the Legal Advisor's Office to coordinate and render authoritative legal advice for the State Department on international legal issues, or as Richard Builder once described, to speak law to power. In other words, to inform clients of the legality of possible actions and work with those clients to ensure that U.S. legal and treaty obligations are met. In this role, the legal advisor must serve not only as a source of black letter advice, but more fundamentally as a source of good judgment to his or her clients. As Abe Shays, the legal advisor to President Kennedy, put it, "The job of the legal advisor is to hold the United States to its own best standards and principles." The four commitments that I identified for the Obama administration, multilateral engagement, universality, fidelity to law, and principled pragmatism, are being implemented across a wide swath of U.S. foreign policy. I will touch on examples relating to 9/11, international justice, treaties, and human rights. So first, the law of 9/11. Fidelity to our values and commitment to the legitimating force of law embody the administration's response to the 9/11 challenges that it inherited from the prior administration. These challenges include the closure of Guantanamo, international humanitarian legal questions, and the like. As the president has observed himself, this area was just a mess, the product of a misguided experiment that set our principles aside as luxuries we could no longer afford. If the last administration had responded to September 11th consistently with international legal norms, the policies we are confronting today would look different than they are. This brings to mind the conversation between two men in Ireland. One of them says, "Well, can you tell me how to get to Dublin?" And the other one says, "Well, first, I wouldn't start from here." In other words, you know, where you can get to is depends on where you start, your starting position. We are now challenged with getting back to something in this area that is both consistent with our national interests, consistent with our values, and consistent with our international obligations. In many respects, this administration has been tasked with unwinding or ending practices that it would not have originally authorized, and is facing the difficulties involved in imposing legal constraints midstream. In other words, at a point where certain actions have already been taken or certain policies have already been put in place. It's much more difficult, I think, at that point to redirect a policy than to start out with a pre-commitment that shapes the policy to begin with. So how has the president gone about this? The guiding principle has been to forge a durable framework that allows us to fight terrorism while abiding by the rule of law. My colleague, Assistant Legal Advisor Ashley Deeks, will go into this with more detail, but as an overview, I thought I would mention the following elements of the government's response. On his second day in office, the president ordered Guantanamo closed. We remained committed to doing that. He issued three executive orders that launched a review of interrogation and transfer detention policy and review of individual detention cases. He instructed the CIA to close as expeditiously as possible any detention sites that it currently operated, and ordered that the CIA shall not operate any detention facility in the future. He required that the International Committee of the Red Cross be given timely and given notice and timely access regarding any individual detained in any armed conflict in custody or under the effective control of the United States, consistent with Department of Defense regulations and policies. He ordered a comprehensive view of the lawful options available to the federal government with respect to detention of individuals captured or apprehended in connection with armed conflicts and counterterrorism operations. He reaffirmed that all persons in U.S. custody, wherever found, must be treated humanely as a matter of law. He mandated that detention at Guantanamo must conform to all applicable laws governing conditions of confinement, including Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, and directed a review of detention conditions at Guantanamo to ensure such compliance. He ordered a review of U.S. transfer policies to ensure that they do not result in the transfer of individuals to other nations where they would face torture. The military commissions law was amended, including notably to bar the introduction into evidence of any statements taken as a result of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, not simply torture. The administration established more robust review procedures for detention in Afghanistan to give detainees the opportunity to challenge the evidence on which their detention is based and to have the assistance of personal representatives. The Justice Department revised its use of the state secrets privilege to give a better balance between open government and national security. And the Justice Department initiated a preliminary criminal investigation into the interrogation of certain detainees. These measures cumulatively seek to reaffirm the importance of compliance with the rule of law in U.S. detention practices, to ensure U.S. adherence to its international legal obligations, and to promote accountability and transparency in this important area of our national security policy. There are those who would say the Obama administration has not yet done enough, and the work is unquestionably ongoing. But the fact of the matter is that for a scant 12 months, these are not small achievements. What might be appropriate with regard to a situation we did not create might not be appropriate with regard to what would be our future policy. Second, international justice. Our efforts in the field of international justice, including accountability for war crimes and other atrocities, reflect the administration's commitment to multilateral engagement and universal standards. The U.S. recently attended for the first time the International Criminal Court's Assembly of States Parties. We attended in an observer capacity, and we are in a listening mode in relation to the court. We are eager to learn more, particularly as the court moves towards its first review conference, scheduled for this coming May in Kampala, where it will take up the all-important issue of the definition of aggression. This issue has become particularly important in light of President Obama's statement of support for humanitarian intervention in his Oslo speech. While this was the first time that the United States has attended a meeting of the Assembly of States Parties as an observer, our government has not been silent in the face of war crimes or crimes against the basic code of humanity. Rather, we have worked shoulder to shoulder with other states to support accountability and end impunity for hauntingly brutal crimes in the former Yugoslavia, Sierra Leone, Lebanon, and elsewhere. In collaboration with Stephen Rapp, the ambassador at large for war crimes issues at the State Department, we continue to work closely with such international criminal tribunals, including the Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Lebanon tribunals, and are particularly focused on ensuring that the first three of these tribunals wrap up their work and hand on any residual functions to a well-constructed international mechanism. Third, treaties and international agreements. As you're probably all aware, one challenge to the goal of multilateral engagement for any U.S. administration involves the question of how to bring the U.S. into international agreements. We have in the United States an unusual constitutional arrangement that requires a supermajority of 67 senators in order to obtain the consent to ratification of a treaty. Now, the legal advisor, the dean of Yale Law School and a longstanding expert in international law, was confirmed with 62 votes in the Senate, which means if he were CEDAW, he would have failed. He would not have been able to get through the Senate advice and consent process, which shows just how difficult it is for the United States to enter into international agreements in the form of treaties. Now, surprisingly, despite this, in the past year, the U.S. exchanged and deposited instruments of ratification on more international instruments than in any other year of U.S. history. This is not well known. President Obama also made history this summer in signing the Disabilities Convention, and Hillary Clinton was the first senior American representative to attend the annual members' conference of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. We are also seeking advice and consent for the Law of the Sea Convention, START follow-up, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and other human rights treaties like the Disabilities Convention, CEDAW, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Seven treaties are up for consideration in private international law areas, including facilitating judicial process, promoting international commerce, protecting children and families, and developing cooperative relations among countries with different legal traditions. Finally, human rights. All of the administration's commitments are reflected in the reinvigoration of the United States' support for human rights. Notably, our decision at the beginning of the administration to join the UN Human Rights Council is one important element of that engagement. Both the legal advisor and Michael Posner, who had only just been confirmed, he literally was sworn in and got on a plane and flew to Geneva for the last few days of the Human Rights Council meeting. They personally attended the meeting to demonstrate the United States' commitment to leading by example in international organizations. We are working for positive change there, not because we don't see the Council's flaws, but because we recognize that multilateral institutions, at their best, leverage the efforts of many countries around a common purpose, and we believe that participating gives us the best chance to be a constructive influence. Prior to our first session, the administration worked from day one with our Egyptian partner to co-sponsor a resolution on freedom of expression in the September session of the Human Rights Council. The living embodiment of the goal of bridging divides that President Obama articulated at Cairo, the resolution was a forceful declaration of principles at a time when that freedom is jeopardized by new efforts to constrain religious practice, including recently in Switzerland, and by efforts to criminalize the defamation of religion. We fully realize the challenges we face in engaging the UN on human rights issues. All too often, in dealing with these issues, the United Nations has been a venue for governments to play politics and exploit grievances. In deciding to join the Human Rights Council, our intention is to challenge these practices and to make the Council a venue for advancing the interests of vulnerable people whose human rights and fundamental freedoms are being violated. A second pillar of our human rights policy is that of universality, that we apply the same international human rights standards to ourselves that we apply to others. As Secretary Clinton has stated, by holding ourselves accountable, we reinforce our moral authority to demand that all governments adhere to obligations under international law. We can and should lead by example, meeting our own obligations under both domestic and international law, and not shying away from self-reflection and debate about our own record. The Obama administration, in addition to mandating compliance with international standards of humane treatment, has taken at least four steps to promote this goal. First, this November, the U.S. will participate in the Universal Periodic Review process before the Human Rights Council, in which all UN member states are obligated to report on their human rights compliance and have their records scrutinized by the Council members. In preparation for this and other reports, the United States is reaching out to civil society groups across the United States for their input regarding U.S. human rights compliance. A robust civil society is one of the hallmarks of our democracy and an essential ingredient of the country's success over 230 years, and we look forward to participating in the UPR process and hope to demonstrate how an open, orderly, and serious review can and should take place in that body. Second, we have already presented two reports this year under the optional protocols to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and our report to the Human Rights Committee under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is due this August. This reporting process can similarly help us to reflect on our strengths and challenges and provide an additional opportunity for us to review our own domestic compliance with these international obligations. Third, Secretary Clinton has announced that next year in our report on human trafficking, we will report not only on every other country's compliance, but also on our own. And fourth and finally, the administration is newly revitalizing the interagency process on human rights implementation that was begun by the Clinton administration, led by the National Security Council. This process was established in order to explore ways within the executive branch that we can enhance U.S. compliance with and implementation of our treaty and human rights commitments. I will conclude by observing that when President Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize, the award was announced as an affirmation of American leadership on behalf of aspirations held by people in all nations. The president suggested himself that this was not so much a recognition of past accomplishments as a call to action, not just by the United States, but by its allies. While these are still early days, the recognition of President Obama and Secretary Clinton's commitments to multilateral engagement and international law signal an emerging Obama-Clinton doctrine dedicated to helping the United States live its values in foreign policy. This doctrine is based on the notion of international engagement, a commitment to multilateral diplomacy, a belief in smart power, that smart power can achieve as much as hard power, and most fundamentally, the view that global leadership flows to those who live their lives and their values, which make them stronger and safer. The prize reflects both the goal and the commitment of the United States that renewed respect for international law will be a cornerstone of what this administration stands for. Thank you.